Several years ago, when I was but a neophyte in this playwriting life, I started to question my own identity. What I mean really was, I questioned whether or not I had an identity at all. This "who am I" was whirlpooling my thoughts. I would list my stats as if I were creating a series of playwright trading cards. I'm half French, I'm a quarter Irish, I'm a quarter Polish, I'm from New Hampshire, white, male, cis, medium, 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 beige, beige, beige. My last name is obviously Polish. It literally means Polish person. But I haven't been associated with that part of my family since I was very young. I didn't identify as Polish, and I'm not connected to any traditions handed down. I didn't speak a word of the language. All I did have were these vague memories of my Polish grandfather looking down at me with his stern, sullen face. He wasn't angry all the time, but man. Anyway, I felt no more Polish than I felt Irish. So I had this constant sense that I was floating around in some self-identity purgatory. This feeling had me questioning what my purpose was. I was a writer with no identity, no grounding. What was I supposed to write about? Being a boring person who is bored and has nothing to say? Ugh. That's like Chekhov without the pathos. And then something unexpected happened. Through the generosity of the Adam Mickiewicz Institute, and with some support from the American Embassy, I was invited to Warsaw, Poland, with a small group of other American playwrights. We spent about a week seeing plays, meeting Polish writers, and learning about the city and country. During this time, as I traveled around Warsaw, which is simultaneously beautiful and bizarre, things began to feel familiar. I found myself connecting with the pulse of the place in a profound way. The people became familiar. I felt I was recognizing them. It was deja vu-ish. On the bus, walking on the streets in the theaters, I knew these faces. These faces were my grandfather's face. The sort of dour stare. It wasn't unhappiness, so much as, "We'll be happy when we have a minute." I share that same look. And I started to feel like maybe I could be Polish? All I knew was I felt a connection to a place and to a people in a way that never happened to me before. I felt comfortable. I felt at home. At the end of the week, the institute who sponsored our trip gathered us together in a conference room to debrief our experiences. They invited two consulates from the U.S. Embassy and a few other Polish theater artists we encountered. It was a congenial sort of meeting. One by one, the American playwrights around the table paid tribute to the hosts with short statements about how they enjoyed the trip and what they'll be remembering as they return to the United States. And then came my turn. I opened my mouth to say something like, "It was such a joy to see your beautiful country for the first time." I got as far as, "It was," before my eyes completely filled with tears and I was unable to speak. I hadn't realized how deeply I was impacted by this short time in Poland, and here I was crying in front of my fellow playwrights, Polish and American dignitaries, and total strangers. So, instead of the canned pleasantries I planned on spouting, I felt obligated to address the crying elephant in the room, the yearning for grounding as a writer, the last name, the grandfather's face, familiarity with the place, the comfort, the connection. After this trip, I began to embrace my Polishness. This last name, which was such a cause for strife in my childhood, became a point of pride. I began to explore my Polish background, and Polish characters began to appear in my plays. Nothing groundbreaking happened, I felt a bit of grounding for the first time. A couple years later, while attending a new play festival, I had a director friend introduce me to a Polish-born playwright I admired. The director said, "This is Brian James Polak. He's a playwright and he's Polish too." This playwright looked at me for a moment, furrowed their brow, and asked, "Where did you grow up?" I told them I grew up in New Hampshire and that I was Polish through my grandfather. With a pfft and a light dismissive wave of their hand, they said, "You're not really Polish." I'm not really Polish. I'm not really Polish. I'm not really Polish. I'm not really Polish. I mean, I guess I'm not really. But I've got this name, and I've got this feeling, and I've got this face. And I really don't know what else to do with all that. Hello, everybody, and welcome to The Subtext, the podcast where this playwright uncovers what it means to be a writer by interviewing other playwrights I greatly admire. This month, I speak with Basil Cremendahl, whose play, We're Gonna Be Okay, recently opened at American Theater Company here in Chicago. Before we get to that interview, I want to take care of some housekeeping. First of all, if you like this podcast, share it far and wide. And if you have a moment, please rate and comment on iTunes because that helps bring exposure to the show. I'm not sure how exactly, but it probably involves magic and laser beams. The Subtext is brought to you by American Theater Magazine, a publication of Theater Communications Group. They pulled The Subtext up off the scrap heap and gave it new life. For that, I am eternally grateful. If you're interested in listening to the 25 episodes from the first life of this podcast, you can find them on iTunes or at thisstage.la. I want to add that American Theater produces a couple other podcasts you should be listening to if you have any interest in digging deeper into the theater world. Off Script is American Theater Magazine's flagship podcast where they present roundtable discussions and interviews on a wide range of topics impacting the theater community. And then there's Three on the Aisle. It's a podcast where critics Terry Teachout, Elizabeth Vincentelli, and Peter Marks get together to address and argue about the latest onstage happenings. It's the only podcast where you can hear three of the great theater critics of our time discuss and debate with honesty and sincerity. We get to read their writing all the time. It's great to put voices to their points of view. You can find both of these podcasts on iTunes. And when you're there, you know, go ahead and review and rate The Subtext. Right? Right. On to my conversation with Basil Cremendahl. Basil is a multiple award-winning playwright. Their plays include Sidewinders, Orange Julius, and We're Gonna Be Okay. Basil's work has been developed by O'Neill Playwrights Conference, New York Theater Workshop, About Face Theater, Inkwell, Rattlestick, Wordbridge, The Lark, and the Oregon Shakespeare Festival. They've been a Jerome Fellow and a McKnight Fellow. Basil and I chatted for a while in the offices of American Theater Company in Chicago just hours before the opening of We're Gonna Be Okay. God, that is so disturbing.
So we've just been in a little hotel downtown.
Yeah. I love how there's a trash pickup happening outside our window, and it's adding a nice soundtrack, I think, to our conversation. So is this the second production you're doing here of this play?
Yeah, and the first one was Humana in Louisville.
Mm-hmm.
So it's great because it's so soon. Like that production was March,
mm-hmm.
So not quite a year, second production, which I've never had them so close,
mm-hmm.
first and second. So mm-hmm. it's good because you have things that weren't working in the first one or things you still want to do, but you don't
right.
usually get the opportunity to go so quickly mm-hmm. while it's fresh
mm-hmm.
Into working on
yeah. it. Yeah, so we're talking about We're Gonna Be Okay. That's the name of the play, and that's the play that was at Humana last year, just to give whoever is listening a little context. And the production that you're working on now is at American Theater Company in Chicago, which is where we're sitting, in an office, yeah. in a lovely office, actually.
Yeah. A little fake
yeah,
fire.
Yeah, there is. I wish everybody could see this wonderful little fake fire. It's so homey in here. So when you were working on that play last year, were you aware that this production was going to be happening already?
Yeah, because the ATC was actually supposed to produce it that year and then wasn't able to, so then it became available for Humana.
Uh-huh.
So I knew that they were going to do it, just they had to push it back.
Right. And did Will direct that production?
No, Lisa Peterson.
Lisa Peterson. And so when you were working on that production, were you already sort of logging in what you want to do with the play for its future life?
You know, I didn't. I just knew that I wasn't happy with my ending yet.
Mm.
So I made a new ending here.
I love the ending so much.
Oh,
I got
good.
To see,
cool.
I was at that was the first preview, I think.
Yeah.
I loved the ending so much. I don't want to spoil anything, even though a lot of people will be listening to this long after this production ends. But, can you talk about how you, what you were thinking, maybe emotionally with regards to the end and what you were aiming for?
Yeah, I mean, it's it's weird. It's almost like the evolution of it started at Humana, but then it's like now really kind of being more realized. Mm-hmm. But I knew that the ending was about these kids in this bomb shelter blowing open something new.
Mm-hmm.
And it took, weirdly, my first take at that was that something came from above.
Mm-hmm.
Like this light from above came down, and that was the kind of explosion, which is like, that's so not right. I don't know, even know why I did that.
Mm-hmm.
But it's now, it's like coming literally from these kids.
Yeah, it's coming from within.
Yeah, which is what it was meant to be, but I abstracted it too far, mm-hmm. you know, by putting it outside the bomb shelter instead of inside.
Right.
Even though what I meant was for it to be inside. So it's a weird kind of imagery evolution, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But the intent being the same, but just like, how do I show that thing?
Yeah.
You know, and what we did here was I stripped all my language away from just the very end, and then I talked with Will about what I wanted it to do. And then I had to go back to New York for something, and he built like a physical thing that represented that.
Right. There's a whole, I think calling it choreographed is not an accurate description, but there is this whole wordless sequence between the two young kids,
which is weirdly going back to like a very first draft where I had no language and I just had stage direction that they were exploring this gender and sexuality.
Yeah.
But then at Humana it got really more concrete.
Mm-hmm.
And that never felt right, but I knew I was helping the audience in a way I wasn't before. This is so complicated without like getting into specifics, but
right.
It almost became too literalized.
Right.
And then I had to strip that away and kind of get back to, and then having become literalized, though, I understood it in a way I didn't before.
Mm-hmm.
So then I was able to show it in a more emotional way.
It was probably one of my favorite moments in the entire play.
Cool.
And it felt so earned. Because what this play is essentially an early 1960s suburban story of these two side-by-side neighbors building a shared bomb shelter in case the Russians nuked us. Yeah. Although I don't even know if you say the Russians necessarily, but you mentioned Kennedy.
Yeah.
So it's definitely placed in a real time, but it's relatively straight in the narrative, where it's like it's these people and they're reacting to the circumstances, and so when they end up in the bomb shelter, which I don't think is necessarily a spoiler, like I think you get the sense that that's where this is going.
Yeah.
And this sequence happens later in the play, which is definitely unnatural, not real. It is so beautiful, and it doesn't feel out of place in this play. Mm-hmm. It feels like a shift, but like a beautifully earned shift. And I think it's this wonderful moment of lift that I was sitting there and like actively going, oh my God, I love this in that moment. And it was, you know, as I was telling you before, I live really close to the theater, and the 20-25 minute walk home, like that was the thrust of the conversation for the whole walk home.
Oh, that's awesome.
Was on that moment. So I'm so interested in hearing that you had a journey yourself with that.
Yeah.
With that part of the play.
Yeah. And it's interesting because I think that there's an unrealness in the whole play.
Mm-hmm.
Which I've had this conversation with other people too. And I think there's something, it like drops into moments of realness, mm-hmm. but there's such a tonally unreal, which is something I like about this production because I think the casting is helping that.
Oh, well, yeah. I mean, reality feels heightened by, you know, 5%, 10%. There's a heightenedness to their, but there is a realness as well. Like you aren't so outside of the real world that you can't emotionally connect to what's going on. Yeah. You know, they aren't cartoons on stage.
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. And so, I mean, at Humana, what I found was that the word weird was important in the play, mm-hmm. And then important in the ending, because, and what happened was I realizing the kids kept being like, you're weird, or there was an idea of what is weird, and then changing that word.
Yeah.
So the changing of weird happened at Humana, but then it wasn't, that wasn't fully realized yet. So then in conversation here with Will and the literary manager, this idea of like other ways to show the change of that word.
Right. The word in this wonderful sequence goes, transforms from being a pejorative to,
like you're beautiful. Basically.
Like it's a compliment. Yeah. It's lovely.
Yeah.
It's like, fuck yeah. I'm weird. You're weird. Yeah. That's awesome. Was that an intent in the going into the original scripting of the play?
The original scripting, like the first, like before Humana.
Yeah, when you're just sort of like, I've got this idea about this play.
You know, it wasn't. It was definitely that the kids are doing something that is changing the world. You know, that mm-hmm. they're going to spearhead this sort of, you know, obliteration of like this binary world that we kind of see in Act One, mm-hmm. where everything kind of has its place and mm-hmm. like no one should mess with that.
Right.
But I didn't really know how to express that. Mm-hmm. And then Lisa Peterson actually was like, you know, they keep saying they're weird to each other. And like, I wonder if there's something in that word,
mm-hmm.
you know, which is like the play tells you things that you don't know.
Yeah.
I totally believe. I feel like that has been shown to me. Like it knows things that I don't know.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
One of the things I say to writers, especially newish writers, listen to your play. Like there comes a point where it's, you've done all the talking to the play, and as you keep working on it, it's time to listen to the play talk to you and tell you what it needs.
Yeah, because the characters have said things.
Yeah. Know,
they're like leading you down a little road.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's sort of, it's, I mean, you're kind of talking about the importance of finding collaborators to help you, perhaps guide you on the journey with the play.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, because sometimes it's hard to listen to your play. It's hard to see what it's saying.
Yeah, the old forest through the trees sort of thing. I want to go back a little bit. I wanted to talk about, we might end up circling back to We're Gonna Be Okay. But I want to go back to sort of how you became a writer. Like what was it that connected you with writing for the theater specifically?
Yeah.
You know, were you writing plays as a kid, or did you, like, at one point in your life, did you discover theater?
You know, my family, I come from like a working class background. I'm sure this isn't true of all working class people, but the theater wasn't really a part of our life. And, I dropped out of school really early, so I didn't even have like a high school. I was like 14. So
where were you at the time?
In Florida.
Mm-hmm.
So there wasn't like a, I didn't get to have high school theater. That wasn't around.
Mm-hmm.
And so really I got all these John Waters films,
mm-hmm.
and I like was like, I've never seen anything like this, and like the really old ones, and I loved it.
Yeah.
And then I was like, I think because it was the first, the script, like the characters and the dialogue was so crazy.
Mm-hmm.
It made me think about the screenplay.
Uh-huh.
And then I started writing screenplays, and I was like, I'm going to make film. I thought I was going to make films like John Waters, you know? And then I got my GED. I went to community college, and I was like, I took the first semester, I took a film class and I took a theater class, because they only had one film class. And I was like, well, they, you know, theater's kind of like film.
Right.
Right.
Right. It's like live film.
Right. It has a script and
right.
they do things.
Were you still in Florida?
Yeah. And then the film class was like, we watched all these films. We just talked about directors. We never once ever talked about the script. And then I went to the theater class and we like read all these plays, and the playwright was like this god,
right?
You know? And
yeah,
like,
yeah.
And I was like, I'm in the wrong. I'm going down the wrong line. I should do theater.
Right.
Like, because it was weird. It really bothered me that we never talked about the writer,
mm-hmm.
as if that had no importance at all.
And it still sort of seems that way, right? Like,
I mean, it sounds
it's the director's medium.
Yeah.
And the screenwriter, most of the time, unless they're an auteur, is secondary.
Right. Yeah, in the theater class, I remember the teacher was like, every word a playwright writes means something. And I took that to the extreme, and I was going to write my first play, and I wrote a poem, basically.
Uh-huh.
And then I was like, I need help. I knew it wasn't a play, and I found this woman who was like running this queer theater in Atlanta, and I found her like on AOL, like mm-hmm. back when AOL, and reached out to her. And then I came up to Atlanta, and she did this like 10-minute play festival.
Yeah.
And so I lived in, she had like a warehouse theater / she lived in it.
Mm-hmm.
So I lived there and wrote like 2 10-minute plays and like ran the spotlight and helped hang things. And, I don't know. It was a full immersion, like first theater experience.
Do you remember what those plays were about?
Yeah. One of them was about like, they were all about the internet.
Mm-hmm.
The theme was kind of like mm-hmm. the internet. And, one of them was about like S&M on the internet.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other one was about this guy who kills himself live on the internet. Like basically it was written before YouTube was like a thing,
right.
But that kind of idea.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, I think that was just those two. Yeah.
I really love, and a lot of people, shit on 10-minute plays, but what I love about the 10-minute play culture in the theater world is it is, such a great access point.
Mm-hmm.
It's such a great, for people who are figuring out their voice and figuring out how to write. And, I'm just speaking for myself. Like before I went to grad school, I was writing for several years. And when I started to write, I was in my early 30s. Mm-hmm. And I was just like, I got to start small. I want to be smart about this. And that's when I found out all of these 10-minute play opportunities existed around the country. And it was awesome because I was able to write some plays and somebody out there was producing them. And it was great motivation. Like you're getting a little pat on the back every time somebody wants to do your 10-minute play. Did it motivate you in a similar way?
Yeah. And then I like came back to Florida and I went to Ybor City Community College, mm-hmm. or Hillsborough Community in Ybor. And, this theater was renting the theater space there. And so I found the lady who was the artistic director, and then she also did a 10-minute
mm-hmm.
thing. So mm-hmm. she let me, like, she immediately gave me a job. She was like, go out there and tell those people to be quiet. There's a show going on.
Yeah.
You know, so she totally just had, she had me, like, sitting in rehearsals, like, taking notes for her. Like, then I ran props, and I came, like, every night to see her. They were doing a trip to Bountiful,
uh-huh.
and I saw it like every single night. And then I did a 10-minute play, which was I feel like that I was starting to find something actually, and that is still probably in my voice today.
Yeah.
This kind of, I don't know. But it was,
what was it?
You know, I can't remember what it was about. I know that it had to do, there was a radio in it that was significant, like the, symbolically this radio that was getting fixed.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't remember what the play was about though. Actually.
What was it that you were starting to
I think
uncover?
There was like a imagery, or there was something that feels still familiar
mm-hmm.
in some of my work that was in that one. I got the reviewer, I was the youngest, I was like 18.
Mm-hmm.
I think everybody was in their like 20s, 30s, 40s maybe, who wrote all the other plays. And the reviewer reviewed them in the order that he liked them. And mine was last.
Oh, no.
And then he called it Tennessee Williams Light. And there was something Tennessee Williamsy that is in my voice.
Yeah. I don't know. Like, I feel like I could take those lemons and turn them into lemonade, like, to be compared to a great master like Tennessee Williams, you know? That's...
But it wasn't.
So were you, at this point, all in on theater, or were you still sort of, like, figuring it out?
Yeah, I think I was.
Yeah?
Yeah, and I was studying paint. I was, like, studying painting.
Mm-hmm.
But then I just switched over to writing.
Do you paint anymore now?
I don't, no.
Yeah. Do you think you write visually?
I think so, yeah.
How does that manifest in your work?
You know, I don't totally know that I understand it, but it's more that other people can tell me that.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember in grad school, we had this dramaturg from London came. I'm blanking on his name, but he was really awesome.
Mm-hmm.
But he was talking, he told me that he felt like one of my play, the play he read of mine was so visual, and that he said that it was expressionistic.
Mm.
And that was how I painted. I painted the expressionistic portraits. Like, that's what I like to do.
Mm-hmm.
So it made sense. You know, it was like, okay, that's just my vision of the world, I guess. Mm-hmm. You know?
How much time passed between this time when you were 18 years old in this theater in Florida to going to grad school? Was this a long period of time?
Yeah, I didn't go to grad school. I turned 30 my first year of grad school.
Mm-hmm.
So I spent a lot of time in getting my bachelor's degree,
yeah,
too, because I switched over. And I also, because I dropped out of school, I had to do so much, like, pre-math, pre-English, mm-hmm, like, just constantly in the writing center trying to be grammatically right, trying to learn grammar, basically.
Right, which is a great unnecessary skill in playwriting.
Totally.
Right? You can totally, yeah, be like, this is how my
people
talk.
It's like, my period means this.
Right, yeah, exactly. My character isn't putting an apostrophe S in their its.
Right.
That's just how they talk.
And I'm spelling it how it sounds.
Right, exactly, yeah. So, what was happening to you artistically in this whole time period when you're essentially your 20s?
Wow.
How did you evolve from that Tennessee Williams light into the grad student who ends up in Iowa?
Yep. You know, I had a bunch of small 10-minute play, so I feel like I was learning about what works in a play and
mm-hmm
getting to work with actors, because that's another good thing about 10-minute plays. Sometimes if you live there, you get to be a part of that rehearsal process.
Yeah.
And I mean, I don't know, I guess also living life.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I sometimes feel bad for people too young. They go to grad school too young.
Right.
Because you really, I don't know, you find yourself in your own struggles.
Yeah.
Too, and periods of not writing. Like, I'm thinking about even that review. I put that bad review, first bad review, up on my wall. Like, I have a review. I'm going to, like, reclaim it, you know?
Right.
And then I started to realize it's been a really long time since I wrote. And I realized it affected me in a way that I was not letting myself see. And I finally took it off the wall and started writing again. But it was, so there's just little things like that and periods of time where it's like, I'm working so much, I can't write.
Uh-huh.
Or like, I'm trying to survive right now. And that doesn't include writing. And so then I think grad school, I had written a couple of full-length plays that I could submit.
Mm-hmm.
And I met Naomi Wallace in Kentucky. I moved with a partner to Kentucky.
Mm-hmm.
And I asked her if she would. I didn't really know who she was totally at that time.
But you knew she was in Kentucky?
I knew she was a playwright.
Yeah.
I met this playwright. And I didn't know she was like a famous, well-respected playwright. Mm-hmm. And then she read my plays and talked to me. She read like everything I had and like helped me
apply
to Iowa,
oh,
and like,
God,
what should I send and and she wrote my letter for them. And
What a gift.
Yeah. Then Iowa was kind of like, it felt like this explosion happened, creative explosion. I think it was about like stability, that I knew I wasn't trying to survive. I had 3 years where they were paying me. I had an apartment I wasn't going to get evicted from.
Like, yeah.
I wrote like 10 plays while I was there. So I don't know if that's
when Naomi Wallace was reading your work, was there anything that, she honed in on that she kind of helped you, focus in your work? Was it like subject? Was it dialogue, character?
I think it was more about, not so specific like that. For each, it might be just a question that opens something up.
Mm-hmm.
Content wise, I don't know if I'm not using the good words for this, but it wasn't so much like your dialogue, your a specific thing like that, but more just like, what is the whole play doing?
Mm-hmm.
And asking questions that opened up things inside the content of the play. Mm-hmm. For rewrites. Mm-hmm. I don't even know if that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah. She wasn't prescriptive or in any way. No, she was just, using her wisdom to guide you.
Yeah. And I think there was a similarity in our imagery and interest of topic that, made that a good connection.
Yeah. I took a weekend playwriting retreat from her San Francisco years ago.
Oh,
it might have been like 2008, really long time ago, at the Z Space. And I was super intimidated.
Yeah.
Because
she's intimidating.
I didn't know her. I knew her work.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh my God, I'm going to be in this. And it was like there was like 10 people for 2 days over a Saturday and Sunday, sitting around a table working on plays. And she was the most warm and generous person ever. And she gave me her address after it. And I was like, I can't believe you gave me your actual address.
Yeah.
Because I wanted her to sign a script. So she was like, just mail it to me. I'll mail it back to you. And I mailed it to her. And she was like, don't send postage. Don't worry about it. And I was like, this is incredible. You don't, like, I'm just some schmo who drove to San Francisco for this workshop. And you're just... Yeah, so my inspiration from her came in the form of subject, like being specific about what you're writing about.
Yeah.
And like your experience with her, she wasn't like, be specific about the subject you're writing about. It was over the course of these 2 days, I was like, I need to be more specific about my subject.
Yeah, it feels like the best kind of mentoring is more helping with what you're doing opposed to these kind of strange specific rules.
Right. And I think I felt that was my grad school experience, was gravitating toward the professors in grad school who are trying to get me to make self-discovery rather than the professor saying you should do X, Y, and Z.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, and I felt like that in my grad school too, that it was very much that... It was very much like, this is the play you've made, and now how can we help you make this a play that is functioning?
Mm-hmm.
Instead of like, here's how a well-made play is. Well, you didn't have a rehearsal. You didn't like, what's the clock? Like all these weird, we never used words like that.
Right.
It was like a discussion. Workshop had no time limit. And it just went until the playwright was kind of done.
Mm-hmm.
Couldn't take it anymore.
Mm-hmm.
You know? But as the conversation went, it would get deeper and deeper and deeper.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I asked this question of a lot of playwrights, and it's answer it however you see fit. And the answer can be, I don't know. But was there a moment, you know, maybe it was before grad school or during grad school or after, where you were like, I think I've figured it out or something out about what I am as a playwright and what I care about. didn't, you know, it's sort of like the light bulb moment.
Yeah. I definitely know there are things that I keep coming back to, not intentionally, but that just arise out of questions in me that I guess I'm asking that are about gender and mm-hmm. sexuality and class. But I feel like every play feels really different to me. Mm-hmm. And so I'm not totally sure that I know, exactly what is like specific about me.
Mm-hmm.
But I think other people could be like, that's a Basil Crimmendahl play, mm-hmm. but I don't know why. But I do, something did happen, with Lisa Peterson actually where, and it went back to that expressionism
mm-hmm.
and because there were moments in the play and she was like, tell me what you're seeing here. And I struggled to just kind of get it out. And she was so patient. She'd be like, it's all right. Just like, keep talking.
Mm-hmm.
And then when it came out, finally she was like, that sounds really expressionistic to me. And she was like, so I think there's just like these moments of expressionism. And then we found more of them.
Mm-hmm.
And then I could be like, this is one of those like moments of expressionism, you know, or whatever. And that was, and then I realized that is a similar thread.
Mm-hmm.
Like no matter if it's like totally absurd play, if it's like a drama, I can do all these different styles, different tones. But a key element is that there's an expressionism.
Mm.
So I think, I guess that I did find that.
Yeah, that's kind of beautiful.
Very recently.
Yeah. As you were in grad school and you wrote 10 plays, however many plays, do you have any plays, maybe it is one of those 10 or something else that you've written, that is your sort of like burning passion that you wish could find a life in the theater?
Hmm.
Or do you have a play that you may not see eye to eye with the American theater, you know, where I mean the general theater of America, where it's you love this play, but so far nobody else has?
Yeah, I do have one of those, and I can't tell if it's just such a mess or what, but I love it. And I know that there's like something in it, and I've mm-hmm. been working on it for so long. Victory Gardens actually did a reading of it,
mm-hmm.
but I keep on doing all these workshops, and I go back and forth if I need to just like put it away or not.
Mm-hmm.
The play is called Sadie Rivers Drag Ball on the Lawn. And it's just like a wild mess, but it's, I don't know. I just did another workshop of it recently.
Yeah.
And think I discovered something that might help it. But
what is it that you feel connected to in that play?
Well, it's, I guess because it's a queer, it's a kind of a weird take on a drag family.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not like a typical drag mother. It's like a subversion of that. Mm-hmm. So there is a drag mother, but then like the drag children, like some of them are like cis straight, like mm-hmm. some of them are like most of them are all queer and like different versions of it. And they're performing wealth. Like they're super poor, but they're performing wealth. And so I just feel like it kind of connects everything I really love. And it's so performative and theatrical.
Yeah.
And it's just kind of like, how can I make it work? Like, it's just like not working. I know. So it's like, we've been wrestling together for like so long.
Yeah.
And I think I started that play in grad school. And that's been like 5 years of like,
right, wrestling the play.
Yeah.
Getting pinned.
Yeah.
Giving up, coming back.
Yeah, I almost feel like it needs a production. Like that it needs a long rehearsal process.
Isn't that... long dramatic sigh. Like, you know, it's so hard just to get a production. Just like a production. But our plays need a production just to be done. And not even done, but like closer to being done, you need to actually have a production of it. Like these workshops, these cycles of workshops and readings only take it so far. You need that first production. And by the end of the first production, it's like, oh, now I see the play that it can be.
Yeah. And it's like they, even places that give you like a week long, you'd think that you could accomplish so much in a weekend, and you kind of can, but if something is a piece that is just needing to live on its feet, it's needing movement.
Yeah.
You have to figure out something that is more visual, I guess.
Yeah.
It's really hard, and especially if it's a complicated piece, you spend so long just everybody getting on the same page, actors getting learning their character, and then it's like that takes 2 or 3 days anyway. So then if you're at the point where you're trying to go beyond just like your early rewrites, then you need sometimes so much more than that.
Yeah, it's impossible to fully realize your play in that kind of environment without having it fully realized in front of you.
Yeah.
Which is why it's so great that We're Gonna Be Okay has this second production. Do you feel like you've now taken it close to its fullest potential or its fullest being?
Yeah, I think so. And one thing I'm learning, which I think at somewhere over the course of all my years of writing, I've started basically, I hardly have any stage direction. And now I'm kind of like, okay, I'm actually doing myself a disservice. Like, I'm not helping readers understand what I'm writing, and there are ways I could help them. And I think that that's like another next kind of step of just, which production helps, because you're like, oh, okay, if three times, you know, people are like, what's happening here? Then I probably could help. But, you know, I'm not going to be around to give it.
Well, why were there so few stage directions before?
I just think I don't realize actually that they're needed. And I think it's obvious, you know, like people will, you know, read that scene and get that someone's left, you know, or whatever. I don't need to say that. And also I want to let directors kind of have a lot of room. But then there are ways though that I can help.
Right. But then it's the sort of double-edged sword of, you want to have the canvas for your collaborators to play on, but then you want them to be able to see your vision and intention.
Yeah, especially like the intention of a line.
Right.
And I know that I write weird sentences. Like this construction is odd. So then that it kind of is like throws people off sometimes. Or sometimes you play the subtext, sometimes don't, you know? Like, I don't know.
Do you find yourself circling the same collaborators regularly?
Yeah, I think so. Like, I've worked with Will a lot. I just, because I had such a good experience with Lisa, like, she did a workshop with me. I think you just find the people, and there's actors that I love that I just always want to be doing something with, you know? But I don't feel like I've totally found my, like, a really large cohort, you know? Like, there's still a lot of missing pieces.
Is there something that this is a super vague general question, but is there something that you kind of are hungry for or need of artistically that you don't have? Is it a large cohort, you know? Is it an artistic home?
I definitely don't feel like I have an artistic home. I feel like there's places that could be, but it hasn't quite turned into that yet. And also I would like to feel like I had a really strong group of actors that I loved and could like call on. And if they can't, then I've got like two more after them, who knows my work, knows me, gets the oddness of it. And, Yeah, I don't know. Or, and I sometimes think I want to do like a Young Jean Lee thing where it's just like, just create a theater company that's like making crazy things. And mm-hmm. I have a job in that. And
mm-hmm.
I don't know.
I think it's an awesome model. When I saw her perform We're All Gonna Die, she did a brief like 3 or 4 day presentation of it in Los Angeles after it already happened in New York or wherever else it happened. So I saw her do it, and I've always had this sort of like secret wish I could be a performer.
Me too.
I can't. Like, I don't really have that skill set.
I can't. No one would hear me.
I have that want.
Yeah.
And so I watched her do this, and also I have this secret want to be a musician and be in a band.
Yeah,
and
totally.
I have zero skill set. I can't sing. I'm tone deaf. I can't play any instruments. But she was embodying all the things at once as a writer and a performer and in a band.
Yeah.
And I was like, man, I want to be her right now. I want to be her. I want to do what she's doing.
Yeah.
It's kind of amazing. She's awesome. She's awesome. That's a great kind of like model to follow, and I think you should do it.
All the way. I wasn't thinking about that part of it.
Are you based in New York?
Yeah, I live in upstate New York.
Mm-hmm. What town?
I live in Beacon.
Beacon. I don't know where that is.
It's a cool little town.
Yeah, I've spent some time. I mean, I grew up in New England, in New Hampshire, and I've spent some time in Poughkeepsie.
Oh, yeah, that's nearby.
Yeah, that's about as... it's beautiful. It was like a beautiful train ride from the city up there. It was kind of lovely. And what was great about it was this period of getting on the train in, like, the dingy city of New York. And you slowly, like, emerge. It's like this slow transition away from all of it, up the river, along the river.
Yeah.
And you end up in, like, this... relatively nice and peaceful area, and it's super close, but you still feel like I am no longer part of the city world anymore.
Yeah, it's like a whole different world. It's the only thing is, I think it's, I'm just having a lot of stuff like, well, I'm not really a part of the city. It's like, it's actually feels further away than you think it would.
Yeah.
So I'm sort of like, oh, I wish I was in the city. I could go see plays more easily. Mm-hmm. Like, you think, well, I'll just pop down on the train, but it doesn't feel like that. Like, it's actually like a long, it feels like a lot, and it's really expensive to get on the train.
Is that impacting your sense of community?
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cause I feel there's so many, I want to go see everybody's plays. I want to see what's happening, but I would not be able to afford that.
Yeah. I mean, that's the biggest kicker in theater, right? Like, it's the, like, dollars are the greatest barrier for people to participate in theater, witness theater, study theater. It's all about money, and money equals access. And if you don't have that, it's so hard to get there. So you end up with a lot of people that are left on the sidelines.
Yeah. And then we're only getting like certain stories.
Yeah. And actually American Theater, had this on their Off Script podcast. They recorded a panel discussion of, four directors. This was like a couple weeks ago. And, they end up talking about this in relation to director studying, directing. And it was, I just listened to it the other day, and it was a really interesting conversation. It really did remind me of, the importance of trying to take down, like, this is sort of like my wish as a theater maker, is that the barrier of dollars was removed from people to, become a theater artist, or to simply just be able to access theater as an audience member. Anyway,
yeah, directors too, and it feels like there's such a long period where we need to do all the stuff that we don't get paid for in order to build a career, which I guess that's everybody. They're doing internships, so it's like everybody's having to do that for some reason now. But then now it's like I'm in my late 30s, my wife is about to have a baby, and it just feels like oh, you want me to do this workshop that I am like spending every night at.
Right.
And you're giving me a $500 stipend.
Right.
And my reward is that you're working on my play, which is a reward. Like, I don't want to say that it's not.
Yeah.
But also it's like, I'm in that rehearsal every day, just like an actor.
Mm-hmm.
I'm, you know, working when I get home to bring new pages in, mm-hmm. plus the cost of getting there. You know, it's just kind of like, I'm starting to feel angry. You know, I'm like, well, how are we supposed to live? You know, how are we supposed to take care of ourselves, our families? And
can you imagine an ideal?
I think an ideal would be, I think Playwrights Horizon is doing an awesome thing where they're paying the playwright to be in rehearsal.
Mm-hmm.
I think they're the only theater that does that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, honestly, an ideal would be like a socialistic stipend mm-hmm. for being an artist in a country.
Yeah.
That would be my ideal.
Right.
That there's a funding in that way for the arts.
Yeah.
That if you are a working artist, the government is subsidizing because you're benefiting. The country is benefiting from the work that you're doing.
I've been to Poland a few times on theater projects, and I've had conversations with Polish playwrights, and I remember my first conversation with a couple Polish playwrights. It was like five of us around a table, and two of them were these Polish writers, and we were just talking about our lives as writers, and their minds were blown by the idea that we all had day jobs.
Wow.
That we're like, we're working all day at a job that is completely like not related to our artistic life, and that commissions are not just like being passed out to anybody who's identifying totally. As a writer. They were just like, they couldn't believe it.
So what's their situation?
Lots of commissions and like working, having an association with a theater that is funded by the government, which is actually changing in a major way because mm-hmm. they have a sort of Polish Trump in charge of their government. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the, over the years, the arts funding has been stripped away, but just commission after commission after commission, and you do one commission and sometimes your play will run for several years in rep. Because that was the other, like that was another part of our conversation. They were talking about like the length of duration of run for a play. And we were like, well, you know, it could be anywhere from 4 weeks to 6 weeks. And if you're lucky, maybe it'll extend to 8 to 10 weeks. And we're like, what about you? And they're like, oh, sometimes, you know, if you write a comedy, it'll go 3 years. And you're just like, what are you talking about? So I spoke to this one playwright, and I wish I could remember his name, but he talked about how through his commissions, he would strategically write a comedy. So because he knew if it was a comedy, it would last longer. And it would keep running, so he would make more money on it. And then he would, the next play, he would write for himself. Like, this is the sort of, like, my artistic expression. Mm-hmm. And it might be dark and daring and scary, and it won't run as long. But I got the other one going, so.
Yeah.
And I'm like, man, to have that kind of, like, to be able to make that decision, to have that kind of choice as a writer is incredible. And I'm sure, you know, on their end of the spectrum, there are plenty of issues and problems and things that are wrong, but it seems so, you know, that grass seems so green over there.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. And I mean, we have a slightly different, because it's publicly funded pretty much by, you know, private people.
Yeah, yeah.
There's a way that they sort of can give that dollar or not give it
mm-hmm.
to a theater. So then theaters have a feel that they have to program certain things
mm-hmm.
and they do, or they won't get the money. And then if every theater in the country could commission a new play, that might change the scenario. But then, you know, they might all just commission the five playwrights.
Right. So you have a child on the horizon.
Yeah.
Is that changing how you see, how you approach what you're doing? Is it changing how you are motivating yourself?
It goes back and forth. Like, sometimes I think, well, am I just going to have to give it all up? And then I think, well, what would that say? You know, I want my kid to be like, come to my plays and, you know, be like, you know, that is like living your dream.
Yeah.
But then it also brings up like, well, how I need more than that. Like, I can't just say yes to everything,
mm-hmm.
you know, and then that feels scary because we're supposed to kind of say yes to everything.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I'm still sorting through, you know, it's not here yet.
Right. Yeah.
I'm trying to figure it out.
Yeah. Have you had any thoughts on film and television?
Yeah, I'm interested in film and television, yeah. And we're going to be okay turning that into a screenplay.
Oh yeah,
yeah, which is my first kind of converting a play to a screenplay. So it's a learning process, and I haven't written screenplays since I was like, you know, 18.
Right. Yeah.
And we didn't get like any film television in Iowa, like no classes at all.
Yeah.
So it's like I'm learning a new form.
Right. Yeah, but you're coming back to your original inspiration, right?
That's true, yeah.
Yeah, that's kind of exciting.
And I totally have a desire to, like, direct my own films and
yeah.
do that.
I think we're going to be okay as one. I mean, not every play is suited for cinematic adaptation. This could be such a thrilling film.
Cool.
I don't find it to be.
Well, we'll have to talk about it after. Maybe you can help me.
I don't find it to be a film on stage. You know, yeah, I don't mean it in that way.
Right.
It's absolutely 100% a play, but I could see your adaptation.
Cool.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And yeah.
Visually. Yeah. Just sort of stunning visuals.
Cool. Yeah. I'm excited about it.
I'm not a person that. I don't think in visuals like we were talking about before, mm. how you're impressionistic. I think in visual possibilities, and I hope other people sort of like find it.
Yeah.
But I'm so inspired by the visual aspect of theater, and We're Gonna Be Okay has like amazing costumes. The costumes look awesome. The scenic design is just like super visually interesting,
yeah.
But yet simple, mm-hmm. And it all comes together. And it's what's interesting is it's essentially a period play, but the way the production design sort of gives it this timeless quality,
yeah,
which I love.
Yeah, and I actually, it's a period piece, but not a period piece. Mm-hmm. Like, I try to describe it, like, because I have to talk to designers, whatever, mm-hmm. as, like, it's, like, our nostalgic look at 1962. Mm-hmm. So it's, like, my imagining of 1962. So there's words they did not use in 1962.
Right.
Like, it's not period specific.
Right, right, right.
But then it has the kind of fun part of that period, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
What are you working on now? Anything new that...
Yeah. I'm working on Playwrights Horizon School at NYU is doing a new program for their acting classes where they, instead of doing like a canon piece, they've basically hired like three playwrights to mess with a canon piece. So I'm working mm-hmm. on a adaptation of Miss Julie
uh-huh.
for them. And then I have an American Revolutions commission from OSF.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm working on a play about this trans guy. His name is Lou Sullivan. And he was like the first openly out gay trans man who, you know, at the time people were like, that makes no sense. Why, mm-hmm. why would you become a man to have sex with men?
Mm-hmm.
Like mm-hmm. what? Nobody wanted to kind of give him surgery or like touch on that. And so he did all this kind of scholarship and researched all these trans men in history. So I'm kind of trying to, I want to tell a larger story about trans men in history in America, but like through Lou and his story and his research and books he wrote.
What was his time period?
It was not, 70s.
That recently?
Yeah. And he died of AIDS. And that was sort of he like famously was like, well, they wouldn't let me live as a gay man, but I'll die as one. So he died in the 80s, 90s, like in that whole, you know, traumatic AIDS experience for the gay community.
Wow.
In San Francisco.
Wow. Why Miss Julie? Were you attached? Did they assign that, or did you pitch that?
No, I asked for them to just pick one. Uh-huh. I didn't want to have to pick it.
Did you have any relationship with that play?
Well, the acting teacher chose it, which we didn't know each other very well, and mm-hmm. she didn't really know my work, but it weirdly fit because he wrote so much about class.
Mm-hmm.
And that's my relation to Strindberg, is like all that he was like so pro working class.
Mm-hmm.
Miss Julie being like one of his most famous pieces. So mm-hmm. I'm sort of, my version is turning out to be kind of about privilege and just sort of, how do you know you have it? Do you have it? Like, what is it?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's actually a pretty great question.
Yeah.
You know, because there is a constant awakening for me in my own privilege. And I think about it all the time. I think about my privilege and my place in in the culture at large, but also the theater culture in relation to my own privilege. And it's like the awakenings continue as long as I maintain an openness to listening to people and having conversations and whatnot. But I think it's an important topic, and I kind of... I yearn for more discovery of privilege rather than pushback or arguing. But my life, you know.
Yeah, totally.
Which is sort of the conversation that you see online all the time, a recognition that privilege might exist for other people, but not for me.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, and then also then. What does that do? Like you recognize all this privilege, you recognize all of your own privilege, and then is there space in that for you to also have feelings about things, or to like be hurt, or I don't know. I'm curious about all of that. And like, do you then have right to complain?
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm curious about the complexity of that.
Yeah. I feel like everybody has a right to do what they want, to say what they want with, sincerity and authenticity and respect. I think those are the ingredients. If these ingredients exist, then, I can talk about how challenges I've had in my life without it being a judgment on challenges that you've had in your life, or putting me above or below somebody else's experience.
Yeah, totally.
I think it's the lack of openness to others and respect for others that makes that sort of conversation a challenge.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. And how hard it is to empathize. Like for me, for instance, like coming from a working class background, then sometimes I have a hard time empathizing when someone who's middle class or upper class is having a different kind of crisis. That's like a more existential, usually tends to be more existential and like a meaninglessness of life feeling that gets kind of brought to the surface, then I feel like, well, whatever, your existential crisis, you know? But then I'm sure, then it's like, then other people are like, well, whatever, you like poor white, like, oh, boohoo, you know? Then I don't know. So I'm curious, just like, how do we find empathy then and also acknowledge privilege and like, what is that? And, I don't know. I'm just so curious about it. Because it feels like there should be space to care and, like, room to empathize. But then it feels so separated right now and, like, so much, like... I don't know. I'm just curious about it.
I'm curious, too. All I know is I have no answers. Yeah. I have feelings.
Yeah.
And that's kind of how I approach it. I can't speak on anything really except my own self and my own emotional place. And I would never position myself to speak for a group.
Yeah.
Any group. And I think that's why I write, really, because my writing is really my yearning for empathy, mm-hmm. and seeking and having questions that I need help answering. So I'm trying, like, I'll write a play and I'll try to connect it with collaborators to help me bring it to a stage, to present to an audience, to help me and complete the journey of understanding something that I don't understand about myself and my relationship to the world.
Yeah. And I think that's kind of why I'm really digging this Miss Julie, because I think Strindberg didn't like Miss Julie.
Yeah.
And then there's a way that I read it and I'm like, yeah, what, you know, like Miss Julie is like rich, like she has like everything. What is she, you know,
right.
What's her problem? And so there's a way of like, by digging into her, I'm curious, like, how can I have empathy? I guess that's what I was trying to say. How can I have empathy for that existential crisis that isn't about survival,
mm-hmm.
but it's about something else? Where's the room in my heart for that, you know,
mm-hmm.
that I could for someone struggling just to survive?
Right.
And like, why is one,
yeah.
is one more important than the other? I'm questioning myself,
you know,
and like my inability to have empathy.
Right. Yeah. Does one need to be placed above the other? Like, life is hard.
Yeah.
Life is hard, for everybody and to different degrees. Right.
Yeah. And it was we read the original Miss Julie in the class, and the student body mostly is middle class, upper middle class, I would say,
mm-hmm.
At that school. And, without knowing specifics, but, generally that's the case. And there was definitely a divide of like people feeling so bad for Miss Julie and that she had been just like used by this man and like, you know, her life ruined by him. And then the other side of like Miss Julie's like a horrible, awful person. It was so interesting. And it felt a class divide about like empathy. And
that's interesting, the divide, like the intersection of gender and class.
Yeah, that came up too. Then it was like, because of the time period we're in too, it's like, you know, people wanted Miss Julie, this like strong woman being like taken down by the man, you know, that came up, which probably wasn't happening too much in Strindberg.
Right. Oh, yeah. You know?
Yeah. And then just like, why did he choose a woman? And I don't know.
It's and so are you currently grappling with these ideas, or have you made some decisions already?
I don't think I ever have a decision,
mm-hmm.
you know, like, I just try to love all the people in the play. Without one being right or wrong or good mm-hmm. or bad or, mm-hmm. you know. I never set out like I'm going to say something. I kind of just try to let it be what it is. I don't know. Just try to have empathy for everybody in the play and see what happens.
I think that's a good rule of thumb just in general.
Yeah.
And perhaps a good place for us to stop.
That sounds great.
When is We're Going to Be Okay opening?
We open tonight.
You open tonight?
Yeah.
That's
opening night.
That's exciting. So how do you spend the day of opening night?
Well, I just quit smoking. So
oh, no.
Normally I would spend the day smoking. So I don't know. Maybe I'm going to go eat cake or something.
Yeah.
I don't know. No, my wife is here, so we'll probably just kind of be chill, trying to do maybe see something Chicago.
Yeah. Are you, do you get nervous, excited? Like, what is your sort of like place when you're getting to an opening night?
I think the preview, because there's so many there, because of the previews really help.
Yeah.
It's like, I'm more nervous during the previews, and then kind of opening night is like, now it's done.
Yeah.
You know, and, I hopefully tend to feel pretty okay about where we are at that point.
Yeah.
It depends. I think it really depends. Like, because this is the second production.
Right.
I feel like I know my play, and I know I've had been with so many audiences now. It's like, some people laugh, some people don't.
Right.
Sometimes it's a good night, sometimes it's not. So but I feel like I know my play enough to know that it's okay, mm-hmm. you know? So.
Well, it is. We're going to be okay. All right. Well, happy opening to you tonight. And I hope audiences love it. They should love it. I did. But it was great talking to you.
Yeah, you too. Thanks.
Thank you, Basil, for spending your precious pre-opening time with me. And thank you to American Theater Company for giving us some quiet time in your cozy offices. We're going to be okay. We'll be running at American Theater Company through March 4th, 2018. Grab tickets to see this great play at atcweb.org. On to the thank yous. Thank you to Rob Weiner Kent, Deep Tran, and everybody at American Theater Magazine for helping bring life to this podcast. Eternal thanks to LA Stage Alliance and Danny Oliver for birthing this baby a couple years ago. Joyous gratitude to the band International Pen Pal for allowing us to use their song for our theme. Check out their album on iTunes. And thanks to you for listening and sharing this podcast. Stay in touch with the Subtext on the Twitters at Subtext Podcast, or send an email to thesubtextpodcast@gmail.com. Tune in next month when I break down the final moments of this year's Super Bowl and explain exactly what went wrong for the New England Patriots.